Gary Dorian is a Reinhold Niebuhr Professor of Social Ethics at Union Theological Seminary and Professor of Religion at Columbia University. He has written 16 books in social theory and ethics, philosophy, politics, and theology. His most recent book is The Obama Question, A Progressive Perspective. Gary Dorian, thanks so much for being with us on The Roadhouse.
Oh, thanks so much. It's a great delight for me to be talking with you.
The first thing I want, and of course, as I mentioned to our listeners earlier, this book is it's a little bit of a history of Obama, his incredibly rapid rise to the highest office in the land, and I look at his first administration. My first question, Gary, is why did you feel this book needed to be written?
Well, I'm out there speaking a great deal in my empty nest years, pretty much every week, and I meet people all over the country who say, I worked hard for him last time, it meant so much to me when he was elected, but I'm not going to do another thing for him again. I'm so demoralized, he has betrayed us, he's nothing like I hoped, and I can't deal with it anymore, so I don't even know if I'm going to vote for him again, you know, that sort of thing. And often when people say this sort of thing to me, they think that I'm probably going to, you know, be sympathetic, whatever, because I've been blasting Obama since he started. I'm very critical of him on almost every policy issue. And yet I think this sort of critique, this disappointment and disillusionment and just going to opt out and sit out this election kind of response that I've seen among so many, or at least the response that says, well, I'll vote for him next time, but I'm not going to work the way I did before. Mm-hmm. I just think it's out of hand and unrealistic. And so I thought, I've got to write about this.
You write at the beginning of the book that when you went to vote in 2008 at Riverside Church in New York City, that you ran into a friend of yours, Elizabeth Sifton, who was very confident that Obama was going to win. And as she came out of the polling place, she hugged you and claimed, Gary, this is better than we deserve.
Yeah.
4 years later, almost literally, rapidly working towards 4 years later, has it been better than we deserve?
Well, no, I think he could have done better as a president. I mean, he could have done better on certain foreign policy issues and domestic and especially economic issues. But I think what the feeling of that moment was that there's something historic here, that it's all bound up with 244 years of slavery and 100 years of vicious segregation in this country, and then the civil rights movement, and then a bridge coming out of Selma that does lead to that moment, as John Lewis put it. And yes, we were sort of full of that moment. And in a way, it was better than we deserved because it's something of a shortcut, you know? I mean, even on those kinds of issues I just mentioned, the idea that you can purchase redemption for all of that in a presidential election is pretty silly. And so, it's nothing like that. It's nothing like redemption. And yet, it's enormously important. And Obama was quite clear. I mean, he used that appeal that he had. He told Joe Klein, there are certain people who give white people a kind of shortcut to their better instincts. And he said, I don't think that's to be minimized. People like Oprah and Michael Jordan are like that. And, of course, he was talking about himself above
mm-hmm.
all.
Mm-hmm. You said, and thank you for that last part, because I was going to ask you about a shortcut to redemption, but... You said that people have said he isn't who he said he was. He isn't who we thought he was.
Yes.
Is he who he said he was? Has he been who he said he was?
Well, in terms of policies, he has done pretty much what he said he would. I mean, he did not have a single risky position in his entire campaign portfolio when he ran. He ran as a liberal-leaning moderate. That's the politics that's in his book, Audacity of Hope. It's always, you know, the one hand and then the other hand, and then he takes some moderate position down the middle. I mean, it was almost a verbal tick. He you know, back and forth and then down the middle. That's how he operates. That's how he thought. And he told us that he was going to escalate in Afghanistan, and that you know, he was against the mandate for health care and so on. So there weren't, except for Iraq, he didn't have anything that had ever been risky. And, of course, even when he assigned himself that position, that was long before he was a national figure.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time he's running in the Democratic Party, that position's playing to his favor. So in terms of policies, I think a lot of folks just sort of talk themselves into some far more liberal Obama than he ever was and than he ever claimed to be.
That's interesting, so, because as you were saying all of that, I got to thinking, really? Is that what he said? And I was on his bandwagon right from the start, but I think you're right. I think a lot of people talk themselves into that perhaps he said something or advocated something or was something that he never said he was.
Well, he's a tremendously inspirational figure, and he, you know, there's certain amount, some of the aspirational rhetoric of the campaign, you know, I'm going to change the culture of Washington and get Democrats and Republicans to work together and so on. I mean, it is aspirational language. It's what he's hoping for, and it's what he's hoping to inspire you to think that he could do. And elections are decided in the middle by independents, and he said to independents, I'm a likable type who's good at getting people to work together. And people thought, that sounds good.
Mm-hmm.
And they helped to put him over the top. And he does believe in all of that. I mean, it's not just a shtick. It has worked for him his whole career, and he believes in it. But that's what he is. I mean, he is a liberal-leaning moderate type who has a history of being able to pull people together. That's how he got to be editor of the Harvard Law Review. He was not in the liberal flank or the conservative flank. He's the one that both flanks could live with, and who felt respected by him. Now, when uncertain things come out, I mean, certainly he's more liberal leaning.
Sure.
There are certain issues on which that reflect the politics of our time, in which he is by far the most progressive president we have ever had. I mean, they're just not even anything remotely close. Obama, you know, understands critical race theory. He was a civil rights lawyer. He is an expert on the ways that, you know, white supremacism sort of replicates itself. He is a feminist. He's a product of all these three social movements that make him far more progressive in his sensibility, just, you know, what he gets, than certainly anybody we've had before. And he rejects that sort of thing on the stump as well. So it wasn't that hard for a lot of people to look at him, despite what he was saying, and think, oh, this is going to be like electing Martin Luther King to the presidency or something,
yeah,
which was silly.
Obviously, he, as I mentioned earlier, and as you mentioned in your book, his rise to the presidency was about as rapid as one can possibly imagine.
Yeah.
And you mentioned earlier in your comments that part of his campaign rhetoric, as most people's is we're going to change the culture in Washington. It's going to be different this time. I get a sense, Gary, that a lot of people go to Washington, whether as presidents or senators or whoever, thinking that they can make a change. And it seems to me that the system is set up not to change, to prevent that kind of change.
Yeah.
Is that true?
Yeah. Well, we now have these gerrymandered districts almost everywhere.
Yeah.
And so you get predictable results, and people just reinforcing their fiefdoms, and then they're, you know, sort of allied against each other, and you get stalemate. And of course, now they've got a supermajority rule in the Senate, so you can't get anything done in the Senate without 60 votes, which is, on so many things, is just virtually impossible.
Mm-hmm.
It's gotten to the point where it could be the best thing now to happen would be a deadlock next December, so that we just end up automatically reverting the Clinton tax rates, which would be a better outcome than probably anybody in Washington is otherwise able, you know, to put together to get anything else through.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it wouldn't be something that anyone chose, but we've reached such a state of stalemate that particular one might actually be the best possible outcome that we have now.
Governance by default.
When we were fighting the healthcare thing, I thought I would have preferred that if he's going to fight that fight, which I think was a mistake anyway. I don't think he should have gone for healthcare when he did, and I think he made a mistake going about it the way he did. But given all that, I think that issue was important enough. He should have just held out for the public option and said, go ahead and filibuster, you know. Mm-hmm. I've got 54 votes in the Senate. Well, you know, you filibuster the civil rights bills, too. So just go ahead, and we're going to have this out right now, and I'm going to stand for this because this is the acid test of what good health care reform means. He'd have had much less problems with his progressive base today if he had done it that way.
You know, I agree with you, and I think that on a number of different issues, certainly health care, it started out like, yeah, that's right. That's why we elected you. Yeah. You know, fight this fight, and then all of a sudden it ended too soon, or it seemed like gave in on something, where I think people were saying, no, stand your ground and let's see it to the way it should be.
We saw it over and over.
Yeah, let's talk about his leadership style. Were you impressed with, disappointed with his early appointments? A lot of progressives that I know said it was just more of the same old thing. They really expected I don't know what the right word is, departure from the normal, I guess.
Sure, yeah. No, it was deeply disappointing. I can't say it was surprising, but it was deeply disappointing for him right out of the box. Just as soon as he's been elected, he turns to the very guy who cut the bailout deals for the banks and then who arranged their mergers so they got bigger than ever. Tim Geithner, that's his Treasury Secretary.
Yeah.
And for Obama, Obama felt that, you know, he needed the guy who was in the room and who had all the friends and the connections because the house is on fire and we just have to put it out. So he was trying to stabilize a system that was deflating in a very, very scary way. But then his other economic advisor is Larry Summers, the very guy who helps tear down the wall between commercial and investment banking.
Mm-hmm.
So here he is, right out of the box, naming the two Democratic officials most closely tied to Wall Street. And the writing's on the wall with that. So, no, that was a very bitter disappointment.
And
it wasn't for lack of alternatives, even very eminent ones. I mean, Paul Volcker wanted the Treasury job.
Right.
And he'd have been way better than Geithner. Certainly, we've got very eminent people like, you know, Joe Stiglitz and Paul Krugman and others, who even if you're not going to go to Nobel laureates, I mean, there's an ample stock of economists in the Democratic side who've got some connection to working class movements and who just care about other things than taking care of Wall Street.
And yet, I don't think we can argue, as disappointed as we were, and that in fact, even though they stumbled and it appeared that nobody had the same number what they needed, that in fact things have gotten better. The economy is in fact on the rise. I'm in the real estate business, and not so much here, but in other parts of the country, the real estate business is experiencing a real rebound.
Right.
In spite of everything, something he did was right because it's coming around.
Well, yes. I mean, he did prevent. I mean, the economy was crashing. I mean,
yeah.
We were heading straight to 1933, and now there's, you know, a few months of it in 2009, and that's where we would have been. And in some ways, it would have been even worse, because at least in 1933, these were small banks. In this case, you know, there are six banks in this country who have 66% of the assets of the entire country. And so you're talking about the very pillars of our economy that were all on life support. And that's why we had to do something. I mean, there's not. I don't like the way they did it, but an intervention to make sure that we don't just crash all the way to a major depression was utterly necessary at both ends of it. And he did manage that with not as much stimulus as we needed, but enough to prevent a full out crash into a depression, and then slowly kind of turn the ship of state around so that today it's true. All the macroeconomic indicators are, you know, are heading in the right direction.
Yeah. I want to remind our listeners, we're visiting with Gary Dorian, a professor of social ethics at Union Theological Seminary and professor of religion at Columbia University, about his book, The Obama Question, a progressive perspective. The other thing I think that's interesting, and I, quite frankly, until I read your book, I didn't realize this either, that in spite of a lot of our criticism of this, that, and the other thing, within the first month of his administration, he got past the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009, which encompassed, and again, this is what I didn't realize, probably some of the most major legislation ever passed within that early an administration, probably since FDR.
That's right.
And I don't think most people realize that.
Well, there are reasons why. For example, I mean the expansion of the earned income tax credit that's in that bill. It is the most important anti-poverty initiative since Johnson. There are millions of people today who are not in poverty because of that measure, that part. And yet he himself didn't draw any attention to it, has never bragged about it. At the time, they were trying to sort of get it through without drawing much attention to it because they felt that, well, the politics don't favor it. I mean, the people, things that are strongly anti-poverty initiatives really don't fly very well politically in this country. He was afraid that, you know, that it would go down if he did draw attention to it. So if you're someone who thinks anti-poverty politics is terribly important and it's a real mark of distinction for this president to have cared that much and have tried something, well, then that's to his favor. This, of course, we have something similar with the health care. For all of my criticism of how that went down and what happened, at bottom, this was a moral thing. He was persuaded out on the campaign trail that this was just enormously important, that it was more important than he had previously been inclined to think. He talked to people out on the campaign trail who've lost their health care because they've lost their job, or somebody died in their family because of a pre-existing condition, or they couldn't find health coverage for their 23-year-old son who can't find a job. I mean, that kind of stuff just worked on him. And so by the time he became president, he is passionate about what? About covering 35 million people who don't have any coverage.
Yeah. You write in the book, first of all, Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader in the Senate, was very clear, and others have been the same way, that they're the Republicans' number one objective for the past 4 years is to make Barack Obama a single-term president.
Right.
You write in the book, Obama is a lightning rod for the politics of fear and loathing. Is that as much a reason? I mean, first of all, why? And secondly, is that the reason that the Republicans want him to be one term? I mean, are they afraid of him more than they don't like his policies?
Well, Obama has reactivated the same right-wing noise machine that, you know, that attacked Clinton and accused him of, you know, murdering Vince Foster and so on. There is that sort of given that it's out there and he reactivated it. But it is worse under Obama.
Mm-hmm.
They stuck mostly to criminality fantasies in going after Clinton. And, of course, it all started with Whitewater, which there was really nothing there, but it enabled all the other campaigns. In Obama's case, no, I'm afraid it's something even worse, considerably worse. You have people marching around. He's barely been elected. People out marching around with placards saying, "I want my country back."
Yeah.
With an image of America's first black president, and I think he has set off a kind of alarm for people who would not say, "Oh, I believe in white supremacy" or anything like that, who think that white supremacy is just about bigots wearing sheets or something. But white supremacy is really, it's a structure of power that's based on privilege that just is presuming to define what's normal. And he does set off this alarm that the white America that I knew before is eroding. It's being lost. And they don't like it. And that's that. And therefore, you have this enormous conspiracy literature that has to kind of provide cover for this visceral reaction, that kind of hatred that they have for him. Because upwards of 20% or 25% of the population does, in fact, just hate Obama.
Yeah.
But why? I mean, they've got to come up with stuff about that. Surely it doesn't have anything to do with race. So what does it have to do with? And that's what the conspiracy literature is all about. And when I started writing the book, I was ready to write the policy sections right away. But the part of it that I really had to go to school on was line up, you know, all these bestsellers that are part of the conspiracy literature and just read them. And I was, oh my goodness, just was appalling.
Well, up to and including, maybe not our smartest celebrity, but certainly a celebrity who, I can't believe it, but was some people were toying with the idea of him running for president, Donald Trump, literally, you know, coming out and questioning once again where was he born? Where's the birth certificate? I mean, that's hard to believe. We don't have much more time, Gary, and I apologize for that. I wish this could go on longer.
Okay.
But you wrote something else that I would like you to comment on. The saddest irony of Obama's presidency is that he has fallen short on conveying what he believes in and what he is willing to fight for. Do you think in his second term that he will in fact grow to that, to where he will be willing to fight, to first of all to let us know what he believes in? I guess he has done that to some degree, and be willing to fight for it.
He has since about August 3rd. He has gotten clear. There's a spring in his step. He's vigorous again and laying out a vision for the country about making massive investments to build a clean energy economy and have focused on the jobs issue. I think he realizes he should have spent his first year doing that, but he certainly gets it now, I think. He's certainly campaigning that way. And I think right up till the very end of July last summer, he still had this idea that maybe I can pull off some huge deal with Boehner, and we can redeem these past months of nonsense. And I think it took him that long to realize, no, that is never going to happen.
No.
I'm facing the most obstructionist opposition any president has ever had, and I've got to have a different game plan. He's had a different game plan since that moment. And if he carries it into a second term, then maybe we can talk about fee-for-service medicine, which is the real problem with Medicare, and maybe we could lift the cap on the Social Security tax, which is just ridiculously regressive. And maybe we can get some work at building a clean energy economy so that China doesn't just totally dominate the market of the 21st century.
Hmm. Professor Gary Dorian is the author of The Obama Question, A Progressive Perspective. I want to thank you very much for being with us. I apologize. I wish we had a lot more time because the book is worth a lot more time. But I really appreciate it. It was a wonderful book. I enjoyed it and really appreciate you being with us.
Thanks so much. It's my great delight.